From KLW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Mission District.
Fremont.
El Cerrito.
O-Town, baby.
Lake Merritt.
Temescal.
Tenderloin.
Treasure Island.
Richmond, California.
Coming up, we'll meet our neighbors in the Oakland neighborhood of Temescal.
It's magic here.
I'm just proud of the fact that we have older people, younger people, people of all different cultures.
Also, we'll hear about a documentary generating big buzz at the San Francisco International Film Festival. It's Informant.
You know, Brandon's transformation from a radical leftist to working with the FBI, it has certain things that happened along the way that pushed him in those directions. But ultimately, I don't know that it's something that makes total sense.
And how you confuse traditional Indian music with jazz. It's time to get funky on Cross Currents. In many ways, the Bay Area is still struggling to recover from the housing market crisis. Although some home prices are rising, only a few neighborhoods have returned to the peaks reached in 2006, and most of those are in the Silicon Valley. Last week, Richard Green, director of the Lusk Center for Real Estate at the University of Southern California, told the San Jose Mercury News that, quote, "Oakland is still dead." Yet, despite the statistics, some areas in Oakland have seen rapid development in recent years. One of them is the northern neighborhood of Temescal. The neighborhood was originally populated by Native Americans. The word Temescal likely derives from the Aztec word for sweat house. Later on, the area was a center for Italian immigrants. Walk down the streets today, and you might hear Korean, Arabic, and Chinese. It's a typical Bay Area neighborhood, ethnically diverse, with a median income of about $68,000. That's close to the median for Alameda County. But as with many places around the Bay, Temescal is changing rapidly. KLW's RTM Konachovs visited the neighborhood to see what typical really means.
It's around 7 o'clock in the evening on First Friday, the monthly art walk that draws thousands of people to Oakland streets. On Telegraph Avenue in Temescal, the sidewalks are filled with people. Many doors along the street are open. People are strolling along, wandering in and out of cafes, galleries, shops, and art studios. They are drinking wine, talking and laughing, and occasionally buying some artwork or jewelry. At a beauty salon called 17 Jewels, I meet owner Julie Stevens. She's lived and worked in Temescal for more than 9 years and seen a lot of First Fridays.
The first couple years we did it, there was like, you know, you're like, when's 9 o'clock? When's 9 o'clock? You know, you're just waiting for it. But now it's, you know, it's 7:30 and I'm ready to sit down. So it's good.
Steven says the event's popularity reflects a changing neighborhood.
It's definitely a changing of the guards in terms of who's here, in terms of the money.
The scene at First Friday is only one side of the neighborhood. A week later, I meet back up with Stevens to see Temescal on a regular weekday. It looks and feels different. Lots of cars are passing by on Telegraph Avenue, making it quite noisy and busy. Some of the popular restaurants are crowded, like Bake Salbetti on the corner of 51st and Telegraph. But otherwise, not too many people are walking down the sidewalks. When we turn down 49th, we see an example of what Stevens means about the economic disparities. A public housing project standing right next to $500,000 homes.
I think there's definitely, you know, families that are here or people that are affording to buy homes in $500,000-$700,000 range. And there's also people who live here that are on Section 8. And there's everything in between.
The diversity can lead to tensions and extreme juxtapositions. Next to trendy restaurants, vintage clothing stores, and organic ice cream shops are McDonald's and a Jack in a Box. And there are other older places, like Golden Gate Donuts on 41st, that have seen the neighborhood change around them. Inside the donut shop, lottery tickets are just as popular among the clients as the actual donuts. Right outside the entrance, I meet Charles Jackson. He says he's a regular at the shop.
Meeting friends and talking to friends. We talk every evening.
Jackson is retired. He spent 20 years working at an oil refinery and another 20 as an iron worker. He's lived in Temescal since 1978, just around the corner from the donut shop.
We used to have a lot of work going on around here, and it's not going on, and it's not happening now like it used to. ever since we closed all the bases now, Alameda Naval House Station, Naval Supply, and also the Army base, the work is not plentiful like it used to be.
Back on 49th Street, Joey Stevens stops in front of a narrow alleyway.
Have you seen the alleyway back
here?
No. I'm going to take you back here. This is something very special and cool.
At first sight, Temescal Alley reminds me of a backyard. But when I walk in, I see tiny shops, an art gallery, and an old-fashioned barber shop that's been open less than a year.
Please have a seat. Make yourself comfortable. Or get some booze if you wanted it.
How long do you think?
Although it's a working day, the Temescal Alley barber shop is full of people. Four or five men are waiting in line for one of the three barbers.
How short do you like? So I just want, on the top, let's just keep it, just, I don't want anything pretty much taken off, just tighten it all up.
Nick Vlachos is cutting the hair of Tomas Schnetz, who owns a Mexican restaurant called Doña Tomas, located just down the street.
If you say words like volume and texture, you lost me. I'm just going to smile and nod.
Vlachos grew up in the neighborhood. As he snips, he explains why he wanted to open his business here.
At first it had to do with the rent was right. You know, it was, we were just renting a shack with three walls. So it wasn't very too expensive.
Yes, three walls. Because all of the small buildings in Temescal Alley used to be stables for the horses that pulled 19th century streetcars through the neighborhood. It's been a long time since any horse occupied this building. But Vlachos says Temescal has changed a lot, even in the last decade.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And if you would go even 20 years back, it was a lot different.
The biggest change, he says, is the crime rate.
I don't know. I know my old boss's wife, the house she grew up on here down just a block away. Every single house by the mid-80s on her block had been robbed at least one time, some multiple times.
Vlachos says it feels much safer nowadays. That might be one of the reasons he felt comfortable opening a business. But there are still problems.
I think people, from what I understand, are getting robbed on 49th Street every week. But they just don't talk about it, and they don't always report it, because the Oakland police have a lot to do.
Crime is one issue for Temescal residents and business owners. But another, possibly even bigger issue, is the recession. The city of Oakland was hit hard and has dealt with a $58 million budget shortfall over the last several years. Many city employees were fired, whole departments were merged or liquidated, and programs to help residents and small business owners have been repeatedly slashed. Julie Stevens says that in the absence of consistent city support, many residents are taking responsibility for the neighborhood themselves.
Temescal's kind of sprung up unbeknownst to the help of the city, right? Because the city doesn't have any money and they don't have enough manpower to really go out and send out their ambassadors.
In 2004, residents and business owners voted to become what's called a special benefit assessment district, meaning the majority of people decided to pay an additional fee to fund improvements in the neighborhood. The money goes towards things like sweeping sidewalks, maintaining landscaping, making banners, and organizing neighborhood events. And it's one of the funding sources for First Friday. Steven says that Temescal has a real sense of community, and many people truly care about the neighborhood. And she says the diversity is a strength.
I mean, I think you look around the neighborhood and you can see the diversity, right? You saw Korean guys walk in, African American. How are you?
Good.
You see white people, brown people, young people, skateboarding young people. So there's lots of things to bring.
Walking back towards BART, it's easy to see the different parts of this neighborhood. Across the street from Golden Gate Donuts is a trendy new cafe full of people drinking coffee and working on their laptops. Up the street, Jack in the Box is full of people. The organic ice cream shop seems a bit empty, as do the Korean restaurants. But in a few hours, that could all change. In Temescal, I'm Artem Skonohovs for Cross Currents.
We'd also like to know about your neighborhood. What are the hidden gems of the Bay Area? Just give us a call to get us started. The number is 415-264-7106. Leave us a message at 415-264-7106. You're listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. I'm Holly Kernan. The San Francisco International Film Festival is now in full swing, with over 200 films from all over the world screening in the coming weeks. One of the Bay Area filmmakers featured this year is Jamie Meltzer. His documentary, Informant, follows the evolution of a radical activist, Brandon Darby, who was involved in the high-profile arrest of two fellow activists during the 2008 Republican National Convention. The film follows Darby's political and psychological journey from anti-establishment anarchist.
Identified as a revolutionary, I felt that the U.S. government was an obstacle to having a peaceful world.
To becoming an FBI informant in an act against the very community he came from.
I just told them what was said, and that was it. As much as it seems crazy that a revolutionary would work with the FBI at some point, under the particular circumstances, I don't think it's that crazy.
And ultimately, he became a Tea Party activist. KLW's Martina Castro sat down with director Jamie Meltzer and asked him about his first impressions of Brandon Darby.
Oh, he's super personable, I would say. I mean, you understand why he's such a magnetic figure to people on the left and now on the right. Brandon came from a really difficult, you know, childhood and background. The film goes into a little bit. But really where he came to prominence was as a radical activist at Common Ground, which was a relief organization set up by a group of leftists, anarchists, former Black Panthers, all kinds of people on the left came together and started this organization, Common Ground. And Brandon was a big part of that. But he was also, again, a really contentious figure within Common Ground. Some people liked him and a lot of people hated him because of his leadership style. He was like a top-down hierarchical leader.
I want to play a clip, actually, of Scott Crow, who's one of his partners or former partners in Common Ground in New Orleans. This is him telling a story about Brandon that, to me, signaled there's something a little off about him.
There's a few stories that run into Brandon's head over and over again. One of them is that he wanted to be a revolutionary so he could go to prison. He wanted it so bad, but not really. But that was the ideal. And so he has this whole prison story. And, like, he just meets somebody and start telling them this story. And you're like, why are you telling that story? It's like, this is a story he made up. So he's going to learn to cage fight and do all these things so that when he goes to prison and somebody tries to rape him, he can defend himself. And he like goes into all the details, like when the cell door closes and it gets dark and somebody tries to come in, this is what I'm going to do to him. Like, and it just made me want to pull my hair out. I was like, shut up already. That is the stupidest story I've ever heard.
That's a clip from Informant, a documentary by local filmmaker Jamie Meltzer, featured in this year's San Francisco International Film Festival. You're listening to Cross Currents, and I'm Martina Castro. Jamie Meltzer is here with us, and in that clip, we heard Scott Crow, one of Brandon Darby's old cohorts, basically talk about Brandon as if he were a little crazy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one person calls him an egomaniac, and you see this, just he's, you know, very effective in his mm-hmm. job, and yet people are really conflicted about him as a person. How did you, as a filmmaker, mm-hmm. stay objective?
I realized in making the film that one day I'd be with Brandon and he would tell me his perspective on a story. The next day I'd be with Scott Crow and he'd say his perspective. What I realized was really interesting was having those butt heads. So I just feel as a filmmaker that's more interesting to make people think critically about the film, to make people think critically about Brandon, to make people think critically about Scott, to make people think critically about everyone involved in the film so that they're kind of making up their own minds. I mean, I will say, you know, for Brandon, he did kind of go off the handle a little bit crazy during Common Ground because of the situation they were in. They were in this post-apocalyptic landscape of the Lower Ninth Ward where there was maybe a couple of houses still standing and everything else was just, you know, ruins. And Common Ground was trying to build something in this atmosphere of total toxicity. So I have to think that that was a huge influence on some of the things that Brandon did both then and even later. I think it was a really traumatic experience for him.
Ultimately, Brandon Darby goes undercover to infiltrate what the FBI considers to be a potentially dangerous group of people at the RNC in 2008. That's the Republican National Convention. And two of those young people were arrested. And this is where it gets really murky. If it was murky before, now people from all sides are debating whether these two young people would have actually created these Molotov cocktails if Brandon Darby were never there. Mm-hmm. And actually, there's an interesting clip where David McKay, one of the one of the men who was arrested at the RNC, talk about how masculinity played into that dynamic with Brandon Darby. And I want to take a listen to that clip.
He made comments about how Brad specifically, and me too, kind of like weaklings. We weren't men's men. The coffee that I ordered, I remember one time he made fun because I ordered a latte and not like a coffee. We didn't want to just be these guys that just showed up without any credentials. That's everything that Brandon was. He was the activist guy from Austin.
That's a clip from Informant, a documentary at this year's San Francisco International Film Festival. The filmmaker Jamie Meltzer is with us. And Jamie, that clip has David McKay, one of the men who was arrested at the RNC, pointing to this element of macho activism, this dynamic that existed between him and Brandon Darby as the informant at that point for the FBI and this group of activists. I found it really interesting that you included this element of gender. Can you tell me a little bit about how you discovered that and how you figured that into the whole story?
Well, that was a really hard one to get in there, that sort of thread of Brandon, who is this sort of uber masculine, you know, macho guy, and had used that, and you know, that's sincerely who he is, and it's something that turned off a lot of people in Common Ground and activists, and he was attacked for it, but that made him be even more stubborn in his sort of like uber masculinity. So, and then he is embedded with this group of activists, younger activists. They were about 10 years younger than him at that time. And he was just acting a role as an informant because he was, you know, he was playing the informant, basically. What he was actually playing was his former self, this radical, uber-masculine activist who he was at Common Ground. So there was a sort of machismo thing going on and people sort of egging on one another within this small community of activists that went to the Republican National Convention.
Tell me a little bit about the challenges of crafting the story arc, keeping us engaged as viewers, and not wanting to leave facts out or details, themes that you wanted to play on as a filmmaker, as a creative person, and yet still staying true to what happened.
You know, what was difficult about this film was there's so much plot, and really it's a film, it's a character study. It's a psychological kind of thriller in a way, as I saw it, of like, here's this guy. Let's figure out how he got from being a radical leftist activist to an FBI informant and then later to a Tea Party activist on the right. I think the focus here was the transformation that Brandon Darby had gone through that I didn't really see represented in the media. There were a lot of vilification or exalting him as a hero on one side or the other, but people weren't looking at the complexities of the case. And that's where I found myself in the cracks between those two sides, you know, trying to figure out what I thought about it and trying to get the audience to struggle to figure out what they thought about it. Because I think a lot of times we watch documentaries and we think of them as journalism, but documentaries aren't, really don't fall very easily into that category. They're not, the documentary is not actually a good place to practice journalism in a lot of ways because you have to reduce things down to like their essentials more than probably good journalism would do. So if you want to access the truth, you're going to have to work a little harder as an audience. It's not just going to be a false truth that I say, this is what you should think. And you know, I just find that to be really a turnoff as a viewer myself. And I felt that this was a good situation. This film provided me with a good situation to create something much more complex.
That's filmmaker Jamie Meltzer speaking with KALW's Martina Castro about his new documentary, Informant. It's playing tonight at 6:30 at the Pacific Film Archive as part of the San Francisco International Film Festival. You can find more information and a schedule of all the movies showing this week at our website. It's KALW.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. The Bay Area is rich with multicultural art experiences, from the International Film Festival to international musicians. One of them is guitarist Rez Abbasi, who mixes jazz with music from South Asia. Abbasi, who was raised in Los Angeles, has absorbed the essence of Indian and Pakistani music to create a new kind of jazz. Reese Ehrlich offers this jazz perspective on Rez Abbasi.
I think some of the most innovative sounds these days come from fusing jazz with the music of other cultures. In New York, a new crop of 30-something musicians whose parents were born elsewhere are mixing Latin, Balkan, or South Asian music with jazz. One of the best is guitarist Rez Abbasi. Abbasi was born in Karachi, Pakistan, but grew up in Southern California. As a youngster, he was more enamored of rock than ragas.
In the household I was brought up, it is a South Asian household, and because of that, there are these sounds, you know, sort of emanating from television and radio and everything. Of course, since I was into rock and roll, I didn't really pay much attention to those particular sounds, but based on sort of nostalgia and whatnot, when I started listening to Indian classical, truly, it just felt, I felt something right away. It was like, oh, wait, this is, I kind of remember this when I was, whatever, you know, 7 years old and riding a bike or whatever, you know, and then coming home and hearing this. So there are fragments of that in the history.
Abbasi eventually studied music in India and hooked up with fellow South Asian jazz musicians living in New York. Some people practice fusion by taking traditional melodies from other countries and playing them in a jazz style. Not Abbasi.
I don't go for the overt influences because that's exactly what they are. They're overt, and it seems like you're not getting the most out of it as you can. I like to sort of have the music incubate for a while in me and surface as it will, you know, and not force, like, for instance, melodies of Indian classical. I don't want to embed them into my music and you know, let anybody hear the sort of disparate influences.
Abbasi regularly plays with Indian American and non-Indian jazz artists who are familiar with South Asian music. That gives them an advantage when they play Abbasi's original compositions.
There's a flexibility with this band that, you know, if I bring in a melody and I start playing the melody, let's say with Rudresh, and I'm playing a certain kind of vibrato on it that's, you know, coming from those lands, South Asia, you know, instantly everybody picks up on it. It's like a no-brainer. It's not like I have to say, okay, you know, I'm trying to go for this semi-Indian, you know, vibrato and whatnot.
In a tune called Monuments on Abbasi's 2011 CD, Invocation, I hear the sound of people building something. Turns out that's not what he had in mind, but it did get him thinking.
I named it after I wrote it, and, you know, there's a lot of subconscious stuff that happens in humanity with us. So I suspect, you know, maybe there's a quarter note line there, you know, da, 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 you know, behind all that other stuff. There's something there that's it feels like monuments, or, you know, you can imagine, maybe in imagination. But yeah, you're right to say that, because it does build. There's no doubt about that.
Eyes and ears open for the music of Rez Abbasi. He's at the forefront of those keeping jazz fresh through fusion. I'm Reese Ehrlich with a perspective on jazz.
Rez Reza Bassi performs tomorrow night at Yoshi's in Oakland. To hear more of Reese Ehrlich's jazz perspectives, visit jazzcorner.com and click on podcasts. You've been listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. The team includes Hana Baba, Wendy Baker, Julie Kane, Artem Skunikovs, Jen Chien, Audrey Dilling, Irene Flores, Angela Johnston, Chris Hoff, Casey Miner, Lisa Ratner, Erica Mu, Rena Palta, Stephen Short, and Judy Silber. Today's show was engineered by Seth. Martina Castro is our managing editor. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Cross Currents theme music is by Oakland's John Santos Quintet. And thanks to City Car Share, which provides an alternative transportation option for our reporters. You can find them on the web at citycarshare.org. Also thanks to you. We are listener-supported radio. The rhymes you're hearing are being dropped by Los Racas. These two cousins were born in Panama, but they were raised in Oaktown.
Oaktown, baby.
You can hear them this Saturday at the Catalyst Nightclub in Santa Cruz. Music starts at 9 p.m. To hear them and all of the local bands featured on our show, visit us at our website. It's klw.org. That's also where you can subscribe to our podcast. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan.